Well, thank you, Michael, and thank you, colleagues, for being here. This is great. I agree. It's very exciting times in hepatology and NAFLD, or metabolic-associated dysfunction steatotic liver disease research. NASH is a growing and unmet therapeutic need, and I'm going to share some of my thoughts around this with you. These are the disclosures. We should not get too upset about a name change or the name. What happens to our patients in the end is what is important, and our patients are suffering from increased mortality, and that's been shown, regardless of how you call it, in a number of studies. This is the Swedish registry studies, again, for its strength, having a long-term follow-up, well characterized at baseline. And you can see in those two graphs that compared to a population of comparators, these patients do less well in terms of outcome. Number of events significantly increase. And if you look at the disease severity, and that's shown on the right side here with different pictures and with different colors, you can see that the most severe stages do the worst, but even simple steatosis separated significantly from the population here. So clearly it is a clinical problem. Cumulative incidence of all-cause mortality is increased. And the dynamic through which this disease has developed, so the prevalence of the disease is dramatic. This is Markov modeling, and this is one of the famous studies that's been cited numerous times, Estes for the U.S. You see the figures here, the fibrosis stages across those 15 years from 2015 to 2030, and we're 2023 this year, is up 63%. The number for Europe is a little bit lower, 44% overall. I think the estimates for Germany were 42% increase in the prevalent diseases, but for sure, this is a big burden, and it's not slowing down, it's increasing. We see more end-stage liver disease based on this disease. And it's not just liver disease. It's a systemic inflammatory disease. There's a number of meta-analyses, and cardiovascular disease is something we always talk about in our patients. There's a number of observational prospective studies that have been summarized in a series of meta-analyses. Now, you can criticize meta-analysis for this or that technology issue, but bottom line, there's very robust data through a number of studies that increased cardiovascular risk can be observed. A lot of adults went in here, and a lot of outcomes occurred. You can see here the odds ratio, 1.64. If you do a different analysis, you'll get a little different number. Bottom line, patients do experience increased cardiovascular morbidity, both fatal and non-fatal. So clearly, extrahepatic manifestations exist. And this slide tries to summarize that complex interaction that sometimes gets our colleagues confused when they try to look at certain disease comorbidities. So clearly, the metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes is a very important aspect of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease pathophysiology, but this disease is not all about weight loss and it's not all about diabetes. It independently of those risk factors increases the cardiovascular disease risk, it increases chronic kidney disease, and we'll need more than just weight loss to actually improve outcome in our patients. And of course, the risk of hepatocellular carcinoma, even in non-cirrhotics, is real and something I do see in my clinic every other day. And it's not all about somatic burden in these patients. There's also a considerable burden of quality of life here in these patients. And I think one of the reasons why we were a little skeptical is in the beginning, because we don't always ask. We're all sitting in busy clinics and schedules, and we're not particularly exploring maybe fatigue, but let's say pruritus, sleep disturbances. We're not very well trained for that. There's a number of tools, and you could, of course, hand out questionnaires. I rarely do this outside of clinical trials or scientific programs. So we do not really assess our patients systematically. This is an analysis that actually went through that exercise and assessed patients in terms of symptom burden. And you can see that tiredness is, of course, something, but also the abdominal, the GI discomfort, the right upper quadrant pain, that spanning capsular of the liver because the liver is steatotic and enlarged, that really gets to the heart of our patients suffering from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and adds to the disease burden in them overall. So I think this is a very important aspect. Now, we've come a long way. We've come a long way because across a number of societies and professional associations, we're pretty much well aligned on how to identify patients with relevant liver disease. And this is the EASL Clinical Practice Guidelines update 2021. You can see that we know where those patients are. Those patients have metabolic risk factors. They're mostly treated in primary care and endocrinologist clinics, diabetologist clinics. And patients with suspicion of chronic liver disease either undergo checkup or should be checked. And in the existence of metabolic cofactors, we have a very simple test that we, as a field, move forward, coming from the HCV area. Actually, I'm going to be discussing this in a little bit. But it's a very simple tool combining three blood-based biomarkers and age to rule out patients with relevant disease. Straightforward, easy, and implementable in primary and secondary care, according to my personal experience and assessment. So if we rule out a patient with significant disease, there's no need for us to actually have them referred. And this will actually decrease some of the referral burden we're seeing in our clinics, I would say. However, in the intermediate risk, we need subsequent sequential testing strategies, and that's also been agreed on across the professional societies. And if we rule in patients, I think we need to follow them in the intermediate stage. There's, of course, the discussion, how much money do we spend to do additional testing? But we want to identify those patients in the end that do have relevant liver disease to offer them treatment. Now, since FIB4 is a marker that depicts advanced fibrosis, it is important to rule out other liver diseases. So, of course, we got to do our basic math and explore the patient related to alcohol, chronic viral hepatitis. There's a lot of liver disease out there. And it will also not tell us which patients are actually cirrhotic. If you fast forward a year and we're going to have treatment available, it might be important to actually identify those patients that are pre-cirrhotic versus those that are cirrhotic. And FIB4 is probably not the best test to do that. And as such, as hepatologist community, we'll need our skills and practice to actually in-depth diagnostic workup of these patients. And I said FIB4 is not a perfect test, and it's not a perfect test for a number of reasons. One, it's age dependent. So age is a risk factor for advanced fibrosis, and it goes into the formula. That means if you're younger and you have severe liver disease, FIB4 might miss you. So that's important to keep in mind. So the cutoffs have been studied in a number of populations, and they're probably not the same. There's some different numbers out in the literature. I think as a field, the more complex we make it, the less strong our message is. So I would actually propagate to keep simple cutoffs and not come to our referring positions with two numbers, depending on age or actually the presence or absence of type 2 diabetes. But of course, that impacts the accuracy of the test. And also, there's some patients with more advanced disease where ALT and AST is normal, and we might not pick them up. And it's not equivalent to FibroScan. That test that we do recommend for subsequent testing has a different angle to it. And you can see some of that inaccuracy in those graphs. One of the studies by McPherson, and I was a co-author on that, was actually showing very nicely how age relates to those FIB4 intervals. So not a perfect test, but it's not a bad test either. We can use it to risk stratify. And then we can use second-line testing strategies, and imaging techniques are something we're very comfortable with as hepatologists. Vibration control, transient elastography, or FibroScan is something that's broadly available in hepatology practice, I think. And it's a test that is standardized, that does assess the stiffness of the liver based on the 50 hertz shear wave exam. And it's fairly easy and straightforward. Now, there are some pitfalls to it. Patients should be resting for a certain time, but the learning curve is pretty steep. And if you've done 50 exams, your nurse will have no problems to apply FibroScan and actually use it in that sequential risk stratification that has been suggested by the guidelines. Coming from the area where we define liver disease based on histology, we always try to think in the categories F0, F1, F2, F3, F4. I think moving away from histology, and this is something we're seeing strongly, be better to actually report the absolute number, the kilopascal that's associated with it, or the CAP, because you're able to quantify steatosis. And I think, you know, maybe 10 years down the line, we're not thinking in those five-tier histological categories anymore, and that's where the strength of that test also lies. You get absolute numbers and continuous numbers. Now, there are more precise technologies out there. Magnetic resonance elastography, for example, it uses the same physical concept as, close to it. It's, in the end, it's how a wave moves in the liver, and if it's stiffer, it's more fibrotic, it detects that. The MRE is very exact, and we've seen a lot of data generated in the clinical trials. From a perspective of a German physician, I can say in clinical trial, I've never had a single patient come to me with an MRE result up front. So limited availability, of course, and the costs are there too. But if you're interested in what's happening in the liver, I think MR is really the test that gives us the highest accuracy in most situations, in particular in clinical trials and NASH research here. And of course, MRE paired with MRI-PDFF, so the amount of liver fat is something that adds to the accuracy here. And actually, the information, or you can get them from almost the same exams. You get a lot of information out of that technology. And they're not just diagnostic markers, but we've also explored them with regards to prognosis. And there is data both for the ELF score that's shown up on the left side here, and the cutoff is 11.3, where you can predict outcome. And patients that start with a high ELF have unfavorable outcome compared to those below ELF. And that's also been shown for FIB4, for example. And you can see some of the hazard ratios that are associated with outcomes, of course, heavily dependent on the cutoff you choose here and the target population you're examining. But clearly, the non-invasive tests we're using today are not just diagnostic, but we can also use them to risk stratify and predict outcomes in our patients. Same holds true for VCTE. On the top side here, you see FIB4 again and the different categories. And you can see that even the indeterminate category differs from the low category in terms of outcome of liver free of liver-related events. But that's also true for VCTE, in particular the 12 kilopascal cutoff. That's something that we, as a group of doctors, have to be worried about if our patients presents with high liver stiffness here. And again, on the right-hand side, you do see one of those typical referral pathways that we've set up and that I think will guide us on the way forward. This is actually how I do ask my referring physicians to do it today and send me the patients. So almost at the end, this is data also, again, related to MRE. It is strongly associated with liver outcomes, as I've shown you for VCTE, as I've shown you for the other non-invasive tests and work that was done also by Alina Allen, among others. You can see that certain stiffness cutoffs are predictive of disease progression here. The 1 kilopascal rule, adding 1 kilopascal on MRE will increase your likelihood of clinical outcomes and the risk of decompensation. So in summary, for my part, I would say urgent and pressing disease. We see a big increase, but we have the non-invasive tools today to risk stratify and predict outcome in our patients. And I think we're in a very comfortable situation to apply that to real life and clinical medicine. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention for this part.